Welcome to Ask the Pastor with Jim Simmons and Charles Lyons, the program that provides great Bible teaching and the opportunity to ask your questions. Our guests are some of the most fascinating Christians in cinema, writing, and various professional fields. Now, be a part of Ask the Pastor.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Jim Simmons, and we're pleased to have you join us tonight. Tonight, we are especially excited to have as our special guest a man who shares history in a way that allows you to feel the breeze coming across the battlefield one moment, and in the next, smell the aromas coming up from the table as he describes Sam Houston having dinner with other leaders of the Texas Republic so many years ago. But first, here is the pastor of Ask the Pastor, author, teacher, and speaker, Dr. Charles Lyons. Doctor, how are you this evening?
Well, very fine, Jim, and I thank you for that very kind introduction. And I just want to remind our listeners, I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are situated. You better not be jumping up to get another cup of coffee or anything, because we have a very special guest tonight you're not going to want to miss. Let's start off with a word of prayer, and then we're going to tell you a little more about him. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this opportunity. We thank you for our guest, and we just praise you, dear God, for the opportunities you give us and this richness of living in a land, and especially a state such as Texas. We just pray, dear God, that you give us wisdom, direction, and all that we say or do that will bring honor to your name. In Jesus' name, amen. You know, our guest tonight is a man of remarkable talents. In fact, over 33 years, he actually opened 43 stores, started two chains of picture and frame stores, and in 1983 was named one of 10 outstanding contributors to the picture frame industry. However, one of his greatest accolades is in his tribute to Sam Houston and the heroes of the Republic of Texas. I think that's very special. He is a man who has a command of Texas history, a unique ability to passionately communicate people and events in such a way as to captivate the listener. It's my great pleasure to welcome Charlie Fogarty to Ask the Pastor Now. Hello, Charlie. How are you doing tonight?
Brother Charles, I am doing fantastic for an old man. But
Very good.
I just feel so fortunate, number one, to have been born in Texas. But, you know, if you couldn't be, you could get here as quickly as you could.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great philosophy about it. I know Jim is a native Texan, and I'm one of those who got to here just as fast as I could. It is an exciting and a wonderful republic to be a part of. Tell you what I'd like you to do, if you'd be so kind, is I had the pleasure of being at a restaurant that you operate, known as the Steamboat House, and at that time you were kind enough to spend some time telling us a little bit about not only Texas history, but also a little bit of the information about Christianity in Texas with an emphasis of Sam Houston. Could you begin to share some of that material with us?
You know, Sam was I think, one of the most interesting people of all of history. U.S. history, world history, whatever history you want to talk about, there are very few people who would be more interesting than Sam Houston. He was an amazing human being. He was born in Virginia, 1793, and his father was a military man, fought for U.S. independence during the Revolutionary War. Sam was raised as a Presbyterian, at least at his home, but when he was 13 years old, his father had passed away. His mother moved the family, consisting of six boys and three girls, moved the family from Virginia to Tennessee. And his older brothers used to tease him. Sam had very little education, but his dad had a great library, and Sam loved to read. He was, at a very young age, even read Homer's Iliad. That was probably the favorite book that he ever read. And it has been said that Sam, that you could pick up Homer's Iliad in later life and start to read it. Just open it up anywhere in the book and start reading it. And when he figured out where you were, he could, by memory, continue on if you stopped. But
that's amazing.
He was, yeah. He ran away from home when he was 13, a little after 13. And his older brothers teased him about being a bookworm and ended up running away and living with the Cherokee Indians for about 4 years. And the chief of the Cherokees, Chief Ulatika, thought Sam was a very special human being and knew that Sam's father had passed away. And he held an official ceremony and had an adoption ceremony where he adopted Sam as his son. And when he was adopted, the story says that he was given the name of Ulatika. And I don't believe that the Indians gave him that name. I believe that the chief asked him what his name should be. And the name was Kalune. Ulatika was the chief. But the name Kalune, translated into English, meant the raven. And there are three ravens on the Houston family coat of arms. And I believe Sam knew that, and he picked that out as his name since there were ravens on his coat of arms. And when he was 18, he left the Indians, went back to his family, and he decided he needed to earn a little money before he joined the U.S. Army. And he couldn't. His mother had a little country store, and he didn't want to work in that because he'd have to work under his brothers, older brothers, who always teased him and gave him a bad time about being a bookworm. And he didn't want to work in the field, so he opened a one-room schoolhouse in Marville, Tennessee. It's pronounced Marville, but it's M-A-R-Y-V-I-L-L-E. But if you live there, it's Marville. And he opened a little one-room schoolhouse, and everyone laughed because they knew he hadn't been to school in years. He'd been living with the Indians. And they wanted to know, what in the world is Sam going to teach these children? Is he going to teach them how to be Indians? And Sam charged a little more money than the other schools, got a few children lined up. His children started learning faster and more and better than the children in the other schools, and pretty soon people started transferring their children into his school until his little schoolhouse was full. Sometime a few months ago, there was a dedication ceremony in Marville, Tennessee, where they have continually reconstructed and refurbished that little schoolhouse, and it now has a statue of Sam that was erected this spring. I guess it's a bronze statue of Sam as a 18-year-old thereabout school teacher. A lot of the Houston family went up for that ceremony. And so he's really remembered in Marville now because of what he did. In later life, someone asked him what he was most proud of. And he said the thing that really gave him the most pleasure was the year he spent teaching children in his school. He joined the Army, and, of course, he rose all the way to being a major in the U.S. Army, fought under Andrew Jackson. And Jackson, like Ulatika, took a great liking to Sam. He really realized he had a lot of quality and a lot of character that other people didn't have. And when Sam finally got out of the Army, Jackson was his mentor. From that time forward until Jackson's death, Jackson was his mentor and encouraged him to study law and learn the law of the land, become an attorney. And Sam worked for an attorney. He read for an attorney. And in a very short period of time, 3 or 4 months later, went and took the state bar exams of Tennessee and passed it and became a practicing attorney. I'm going to skip around a little bit and say that probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to Sam, because he led a pretty wild life. Jackson wanted him to run for Congress. And Jackson, of course, was very well known in Tennessee. He had been a congressman, a senator, and was eventually governor. And with Jackson's backing, Sam was elected 2 terms to the U.S. Congress from Tennessee. And then Jackson wanted him to run for governor of Tennessee, and he ran for it and was elected. Unfortunately, Jackson gave him some information, I believe, that didn't help him a whole lot. I think Jackson encouraged him to find himself a bride and settle down. It would be better for his political career. And the young lady that he married, Eliza Allen, 11 weeks after Sam and Eliza were married, Eliza went back home to Daddy. And she was from a very prominent family in Tennessee, and her family was very strong in the Presbyterian Church. And Sam went to the officers of that church and asked if he could be baptized. And her family was very prominent in that church, and he was turned down. They wouldn't baptize him.
And, oh, goodness.
And he ended up going back to the Indians and living with them again, and apparently had an Indian ceremony where he ended up marrying an Indian woman who was half Indian, half Anglo, Tiana Rogers, or Tiana or Diana Rogers. And she was apparently some way kin to Will Rogers, maybe through his Will Rogers grandmother. But Sam lived with the Indians a few years, negotiated some treaties between the Cherokees. At that time, those Indians had been moved from Tennessee and North Carolina, had been moved to what is now Oklahoma, Arkansas and Oklahoma. And Sam went and negotiated some treaties between the Indians and the folks at Washington. And on one of his trips to Washington, there was a congressman by the name of William Stanberry that said some unkind things about Sam that got published in the newspapers. And Sam was a little hot under the collar. He didn't like what had been published about him. The fellow had claimed that he was a crook and been stealing money under the table from the Indians. When Sam joined the U.S. Army, his mother gave him a little ring, a little gold ring, and the inside of that ring had one word inscribed in it. And I don't think anyone else but Sam, his mother, and the jeweler who did the inscription knew what that word was until quite a few years later. And the one word she had inscribed in that was the word honor. And she told Sam as he joined the Army, she said, "I would rather have one grave filled with all of my sons if they died in defense and honor to their country than to have any one of my sons ever turn his back on our country." And Sam, I think, lived by that code much of his life. And he ended up, when this fellow Stanberry said some unkind things that got written in the newspapers, he and Stanberry had a little showdown. Stan wanted to talk to us, whatever, did the newspapers really get it right, or did they change the story? And they ended up in a little pushing and shoving, and Sam apparently poked Stanberry with his walking stick. Stanberry thought he'd been poked too hard and pulled his little Derringer-type pistol out of his pocket, stuck it on Sam's chest, and pulled the trigger, and all it did was click.
And the folks standing by heard
it click one more time, but Stanberry didn't have another chance, so Sam took his walking stick and commenced to beat the stuffings out of Stanberry. And when Stanberry recuperated, he insisted that Congress put Sam on trial, and Congress had him arrested, put him on trial. And the interesting thing is, Sam was an attorney, but he got himself a very prominent attorney to represent him in this trial, and that fellow's name was Francis Scott Key.
Whoa.
And when the trial was over with, Sam was fined $500. And rather than pay the fine, he decided to pack his stuff up, go back to what is now Oklahoma and Arkansas, to where the Indians were, and leave the United States. And his friend Jackson was president and gave him he forgave the $500 fine. Jackson eliminated it. Most people think, and I'm one of them that would think that Jackson wanted him to go to Texas and see what was going on, because Stephen F. Austin had brought settlers in on the agreement that his father had made, and then his father died before he could get it off the ground, Moses Austin. And there was a lot of turmoil going on because the then Mexican government was starting to change all the rules that they had allowed settlers to operate under in Texas. And Sam crossed the Red River and came to Texas on December the 2nd, 1832. And to a degree, a lot of the rest of it almost is history. What is really interesting is, of course, we had the Battle of the Alamo. We had the, which is one of them where the 189 men, including Travis, who was the young commander of the Alamo, were all killed. And then we had the massacre of the folks that had surrendered at Calito Creek, another battle, surrendered to another Mexican army, under the agreement or understanding that if they gave up their weapons, the Mexican army would let them go as long as they left Texas and go back to wherever they had come from, whether it was out of the country or, you know, out of, to the United States or countries across in Europe. And instead of that happening, the commander, General Urrea, had to send a message to Santa Ana to say, we've taken about 500 prisoners. What do we do with them? And Urrea knew what the answer was, so he turned the command over to someone else, and he went to Victoria to take care of a little business there. Because the answer coming back is, we don't take prisoners. Take them out and shoot them. And 431 men were massacred 3 weeks after the fall of the Alamo. And,
wow.
431, there were several. There were probably 30 to 50 who escaped and eventually did join up with Sam Houston's army and were present and active at the Battle of San Jacinto, which is why the battle cry at San Jacinto was not only remember the Alamo, but remember Goliath.
Right.
And, of course, Sam was the commander. He was the genius behind when to strike and when not to strike. He eventually led the Texas Army to strike the Mexican Army one afternoon on April the 21st at about 3:30 when the Mexican Army was taking a siesta. And the Texas Army was someplace around probably at that time between 750 and 850, someplace in that neighborhood. And the Mexican Army was about 1,400. But it was done with such surprise that the Texas Army lost, depending on what history book you read, they lost about 9 men that either died that day or died the following day, and the Mexican Army lost about half of their men. And Sam, during that battle, had his left ankle, or just above his left ankle, had his leg shattered. And we have the greatest hospital systems, I think, in the country or the world here in Texas, in Houston now. But in those days, the closest hospital was New Orleans. And a doctor, Alexander Ewing, decided to take care of Sam in spite of the fact that the then temporary president, David G. Burnett, decided, he told the doctor not to spend so much time with Sam. And the doctor, Alexander, knew how important Sam was, and he wouldn't obey the then David G. Burnett, the then temporary president. What is also known is by history is when they finally got a little ship, a little steamship, to come around to the battleground to pick up Sam, to pick up the officers of the Republic of Texas, to pick up Santa Ana, who by then was captured and was a captive and being held prisoner, the Emperor of Mexico. The officers of the Republic of Texas, when they got ready to leave, said, just leave Sam Houston here. He's not going to live anyway. Just leave him here and let him die. And the captain of the ship said, ship's not leaving until Sam's on it. So if you want to stay here forever, we will, but we're not. This ship's not leaving without Sam. And so they finally had to bend, and Sam was taken and dropped off at Galveston and needed to be taken as far as New Orleans to go to the only hospital. And turns out that some unique things happened. And I think God gets his finger in things and does some things that are really, when you look at them, are miraculous.
Yes.
When Sam finally got to New Orleans, the battle took place April the 21st. He was in such bad shape that Dr. Ewing, who did not make the trip with him, did everything he could to get him prepared. But Dr. Ewing said as Sam's ship left, he said, more than likely Houston will be dead before he gets there. He'll probably die of lockjaw. Well, Sam made it to New Orleans. When they were taking him off the ship, a band there played some, who was on that ship, played some patriotic music. There was a group high school senior girls visiting New Orleans from Marion, Alabama. And in that group was a young lady by the name of Margaret Lee, 17-year-old Margaret Lee. There was Sam Houston at the time was 43 years old. Ironically, a few years later, Margaret Lee, Sam met Margaret and fell in love with her, and eventually Sam and Margaret got married. But Margaret, who found out she wanted to know who in the world that was that they were playing this patriotic music for, and they said, oh, that's General Houston. The word of what had happened at San Jacinto had gotten to New Orleans several weeks earlier. And she wrote in her diary about seeing General Houston being taken off this ship, the hero of the Battle of San Jacinto, and wrote all about it. And she always kept a diary. And at the end of that entry into her diary, she wrote that, I have a premonition that I may meet him someday. He gets his surgery. They remove 20-some-odd bone fragments from his leg. And about 10 days later, he's on a ship going back to Texas. When we finally get to the point of holding elections, Sam is elected the first president of the Republic of Texas. And he serves a 2-year term. And then after his 2-year term, he ran for and was elected a congressman from the Nacogdoches area because he wanted to keep his finger in what was going on in Texas. Could not succeed himself and could only have 1 2-year term at a time. Well, in that period of time, he also wanted to purchase some good mares. He had a nice stallion. He wanted to breed some horses. And he went on a business trip to, number one, peddle some land that he and some of his fellow compatriots thought would be the new great port city of Texas. And they acquired some leagues of land around Sabine City at the mouth of Sabine Pass, which connects to both the Trinity River and Sabine River and flows through Sabine Lake. But they thought that would be the new great port city. And, of course, Sabine separates Texas from Louisiana, but they thought that would be the port city. And he was over peddling some of this real estate in addition to purchasing some mares from someone that had some nice mares in Mobile, Alabama. And he called on a businessman by the name of Martin Lee. And Martin put together a group in his home to come in that evening to hear about Sam making this presentation on the opportunity for real estate in Texas. And he invited his mother, who had recently sold some real estate, knew she had some money to invest in some others. He invited his brother-in-law, a fellow by the name of William Bledsoe, and he also invited, when he invited his mother, I'm sure that that Nancy Lee said to Margaret where she was going to see her son, Margaret's brother, and hear a presentation by Sam Houston. And I'm sure she decided, you know what, I had a premonition I would meet him one day. We're talking about this time at least 3 or 3.5 to 4 years later. And she goes to this gathering, and Sam is introduced to William. This is William Bledsoe, my brother. Martin Lee introduces him. This is Margaret, my sister. And Sam assumed that Margaret was married to William Bledsoe. And later on that evening, he said something to someone at that gathering, said, boy, if that one wasn't married, I'd give her a chance to say no tonight. And they said, Sam, that's not Bledsoe's wife. That's Bledsoe's wife's older sister, and she's single. And they spent some time in the garden that night. And Margaret even later on, wrote a poem about it. And the ironic thing, the name of that poem was when they went into the garden, they could see one bright star that night. And the name of that poem was Our Star of Destiny. In the book about all of this, put together by one of their great-great-granddaughters who had access to Margaret's diaries and the letters between Sam and Margaret, it doesn't say whether or not he proposed to her that night, but I think everyone thinks that he did, and everyone thinks she said yes. And about a year or so later, Sam and Margaret were married, and Margaret and Sam and several slaves that Margaret had inherited when her father died when she was about 15, but there were several slaves that she had taken a great interest in, and in his will had left Joshua and Eliza to Margaret. Joshua was a young slave that was born on the Lee plantation. Margaret did something that was illegal, taught him how to read and write when he was a young child. Mm. Very intelligent young man. And he also learned to trade to be a blacksmith and a wheelwright. And Sam treated him like a son. Eliza was very close to Margaret. Margaret talked her father into purchasing Eliza, who had apparently been kidnapped somewhere in the southeast and taken many miles into Marion, Alabama, she was being auctioned off. And the poor girl was crying her eyes out, had no idea what was happening to her, and Margaret talked her dad, Temple, into purchasing Eliza, and he did. You know, I've got a couple of daughters and a couple of sons, but my daughters, when they say, "Daddy, please," I was always in trouble. So I know what Margaret was doing to Daddy was, "Daddy, please."
Uh-huh.
And Eliza and Margaret were like sisters the rest of their lives. In fact, Margaret died at a fairly early age. She was about 48, but she died several years after Sam did. But Sam, at the time that they first met, Sam was a drunk. He had an alcohol problem caused by many wounds that he had from the military that were painful to him. And he also got to the point where he just was an alcoholic, just couldn't leave it alone. And after their marriage, I don't think Margaret bugged him a lot about his drinking, but I think Sam, who was 26 years older than this good-looking young gal that was really crazy about him, I think he eventually, finally quit alcohol because he wanted to please Margaret. Once they got married, he was elected to be the third president of the Republic after Mirabeau B. Lamar had been the second president. When we finally joined the U.S., he was one of the first two U.S. senators, spent 13 years in the U.S. Senate. The sad thing was that because he was in the Senate, he spent a lot of time out of Texas. And Margaret had asthma, didn't travel a lot, thank goodness for Eliza, because she would always help Margaret when she had a health problem. They lived most of their married life in Huntsville, Texas. Huntsville, Texas was a stage stop from Nacogdoches to Huntsville, then over to Anderson, or going back the other direction. And Sam had an agreement with the slaves. He told their slaves that if you can find employment anywhere, you can find employment once you get through with your chores for us each day, and you can go work and keep the money that you get paid for your employment. Well, that was Joshua had learned how to be a blacksmith and a wheelwright on the Lee plantation. And every time he'd get through with his chores, and Sam treated Joshua just like he was a son. He taught him about business when they built their home. Sam was gone most of the time as a U.S. senator, and he gave Joshua a ledger to keep track of the cost and of everything they had that they put into that house, so he'd teach him how to be a businessman. When Sam eventually passed away at age 70, Joshua knew that Sam and Margaret were basically broke. By then, he had been a U.S. senator 13 years. He came back to run for governor of Texas. When Texas voted to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy, Sam was the governor, but he would not sign the papers. He did not want to see Texas secede from the Union and join the Confederacy. In fact, a lot of the history books say that Lincoln sent Sam a letter when he was governor of Texas offering to send from 50,000 to 75,000 troops to Texas to try to keep Texas in the Union. And Sam and several of his compadres were in the governor's mansion, read that letter, talked about it, discussed it, and finally Sam threw the letter in the fireplace and burned it. Because if you would have sent 50,000 to 75,000 troops into Texas, Texas would have turned into a battlefield, and he did not want to see that happen. But... So he was thrown out of office, as when he would not sign the papers to secede and Texas had voted to secede. And he and his Sam and his family moved back to Huntsville. They stayed in a strange-looking home up there. They were broke, and they stayed there until Sam passed away. And Joshua, the slave who was the blacksmith and the wheelwright who had adopted the name Houston, Joshua went to Margaret and tried to give Margaret, he knew they were broke, tried to give Margaret the money that he had saved up. And Margaret, who was very fond of Joshua, again, she had taught him how to read as a little kid. They were very close. And Margaret told Joshua, said, Joshua, I will not accept your money. And the reason I won't accept your money is that the general would not accept your money. He would want you to take that money and better your family and educate your children. There is a great book about Joshua called From Slave to Statesman. And Joshua became a pillar of the community in Huntsville, Texas. During Reconstruction, where we didn't have voting in Texas, Joshua on two occasions was named a city alderman in Huntsville, Texas. After that, on two occasions, he was elected, a county commissioner in Walker County, which is where Huntsville is. He started schools for the black children to educate them from first grade all the way up till they were through high school. He attempted to start a black university, which didn't financially make it, but he made that attempt. And but he educated his kids. He taught them all about everything from the Lord to business. And a couple of years ago, I ran into the first of two gentlemen that I've met who are descendants of Joshua Houston. One of them, if people what is that?
No, I said that's amazing to find that connection after all those years.
One of them is a fellow who is very famous in the football histories. And I met him at a golf tournament, and we were purchasing some golf shirts they had on there for a real big break at this celebrity golf tournament, and he was one of the celebrities. And I thought he was probably a baseball player because most of the celebrities were retired baseball players. And we were standing in line to buy our shirts for about 15 cents on the dollar. We introduced ourselves to each other, and he said, "My name's Kenny Houston." And it took me about 2 seconds to say, "Kenny, where'd you get that Houston name from?" I told him later, I said, "Do you realize you got an inch and a half taller and stuck your chest out when you said, 'I got that from Sam Houston'?" And he said, "I'm a descendant of Joshua Houston, Jr." And I said, "I make talks about Joshua because Joshua was Sam's right-hand man." And I said, he treated Sam like a father and Sam treated him like a son. And I said, there's a whole book about Joshua called From Slave to Statesman, the story about Joshua Houston. Well, that night when I got home from the golf tournament, pardon me.
God bless you.
I tried to take a little sip of water and it didn't work. When I got home from the tournament, I grabbed my book about Joshua Houston. Kenny grew up in Crockett, Texas, up in East Texas. Played football, got a scholarship. Football scholarship to play at Prairie View University between here and Hempstead. And he was a six-round draft choice by a fellow that was a football coach for the Oilers two times and never got fired, Wally Lim.
Yep.
And Wally, at Prairie View, they'd made him a lineman. Well, Kenny's 6'4" and not built like a lineman, but he was a six-round draft choice. You know what they write about you, a six-round draft choice? Nothing. Well, Wally looked at him and said, "I'm going to make him a defensive back." And he started training to be a strong safety, even though they had a strong safety. And about four or five games into the season, during one of their scrimmages, the strong safety got hurt, and Kenny got to play his first game as a strong safety. And the first game he ever played as a strong safety is in the NFL. And in his first game, he picks up a fumble and runs it back for a touchdown. Same game, he intercepts a pass, runs it back for a touchdown. The poor guy that had been the strong safety didn't get his job back. Kenny played for about 5 years for Houston, And then the played 6 years, I think. Then the Washington Redskins wanted him so badly, they traded 5 good season players to Houston, who had a terrible team. They traded 5 good players to Houston to pick up Kenny Houston. He finished his career at Washington and is in the NFL Hall of Fame. And just the finest gentleman you'd ever want to run into. And Kenny and I keep up with each other. I would like for him to put a book, for me to help him put a book together. And the name of the book would be My Connection to, in small print, Sam Houston by NFL Hall of Famer Kenny Houston. Because all the people that love football and love the old Love You Blue Houston Oilers would want to read all about Kenny Houston. And the
Absolutely.
People who love Texas history would love it. But he's just a real fine gentleman, lives out in the Kingwood area of Houston. And we get together from time to time. But he is just a great guy. But Sam's mother-in-law and his wife worked on him enough to where he was at the Sam's mother-in-law, when she came to Texas, eventually moved to Independence, Texas, which is where Baylor University started. And Sam and Margaret had a little farm they purchased in Independence when they were still living in Huntsville. And Sam and Margaret, of course, used to go visit the mother-in-law. And Sam finally accepted Jesus Christ as his Lord and was baptized in Rocky Creek by Rufus Burleson, who was the pastor at the Independence Baptist Church. And when Sam came up out of the water, he asked Rufus, said, "Are my sins washed away?" And Rufus said, "Yes." And I would say the most quoted thing of Sam Houston is what he said when Rufus told him that his sins had been washed away. He said, "Pity the poor fish downstream." Sam had a great memory, and he really studied the Bible. And I was telling you the other day, and I've read about 3/4 of that book that was given to me last week, and it's called The Life of Sam Houston. And it's you looked it up on the Internet, and you said there was an author written somebody's name in it or on the Internet. But in the book, it doesn't say who the author is, because the real author was Sam Houston. And he apparently put most of that book together at various times during his life and finished it up probably when he was a U.S. senator. And the book was published in 1855 in New York City. And I don't know if you've looked at any of it. You again pulled it up. You said you were going to download it. But when you read this thing, Sam was such a brilliant human being and had such a brilliant education that the wording in that book just absolutely blows you away. It has words in there that I'd never even seen before. That if you keep reading it, you're
going to Charlie, let me jump in on that.
All right.
One thing I was going to mention is we'll put a link down below that'll be available tomorrow afternoon. So if people would like to get more information about that book, they can find out about it. I agree with you. I've had a chance to read a little bit of it so far, and I think people who only have access to the public school system and some movies, maybe out of Hollywood, they probably do not picture Sam Houston as someone who is highly educated. And, I mean, he had a working education, I think, to put it well. And when you read that book, you begin to get some insight. I said, this is not somebody who's got only rough edges. He had quite the mind and a very strong communication. So I can only imagine from seeing his writing what it must have been like to sit across from him and hear him, speak about Texas and speak about freedom. I think it had to be a remarkable thing. I'm going to ask you to do one other thing for us, too. When I heard you speak before, you were kind enough to share something that is so very obvious and yet never taught about. At the Alamo, there was a flag that was flying. That's referred to as the 1824 Alamo flag. Would you tell some folks what was the significance of that flag?
Well, that flag was a protest flag, protesting the fact that when Santa Anna became he was elected the president of Mexico, and then he declared himself A few weeks later, he declared himself the emperor, the dictator of Mexico. And Mexico had gained their independence in 1821 from Spain. And in 1824, they had adopted a constitution that was based an awful lot on the U.S. Constitution. In fact, Stephen F. Austin helped them do a lot of work. Austin was a student of the U.S. Constitution, and he helped them an awful lot to put their Constitution of 1824 together. And Santa Anna had done away with the Constitution of 1824 and done away with a whole lot of other of the laws of Mexico. And the fellows at the Alamo raised a flag at the Alamo, and it was red, white, and green, like the colors of the Mexican flag. But across the center area, in the white area, had 1824 on it, protesting the fact that the Constitution, Mexican Constitution of 1824, had been done away with. That flag, along with a flag of the some group of volunteers that came from New Orleans, were called the New Orleans Grays because they had apparently gray uniforms. The flag of the New Orleans Grays, and the flag of 1824, the protest of the Constitution that had been done away with, were both captured as the fall of the Alamo. Santa Anna had those sent back to Mexico. And those flags are apparently still in a Mexican museum, and have been there for years and years and years. Texas tried to get them back numerous times, but were incapable of doing that. But they are still in a museum apparently in Mexico City, flags that were captured at the Alamo, at the fall of the Alamo. And Santa Anna wanted that flag of the New Orleans Grays to prove that this was it was the U.S. meddling in Texas affairs. But the interesting thing is there were fellows that died there at the Alamo from Scotland, from England, from Ireland, and maybe one from Germany and somebody from Belgium. But there were lots of folks that died from even outside of the country that come here and had immigrated to Texas. There were several impresarios in South Texas who were from Ireland, and they brought a lot of folks over from Ireland. There were about, I think it was supposed to be 25 fellows who died at the Goliad from Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I guess, probably Ireland or Scotland had the most, were from the foreign countries, had a lot of folks that died from the Alamo. At the Alamo, the greatest number of volunteers that died were from any one single state in the United States, were from Tennessee. But at a special ceremony that's held every year on March the 6th, which is the fall of the Alamo, there's a ceremony held at 6 o'clock in the morning, which is about the time that the Alamo fell. And usually the Daughters of the Republic of Texas hold another ceremony that afternoon, honoring the and telling you how many men died there from the various states and the various countries. And they bring some fellas and gals in from the military bases around San Antonio to carry the flag of each one of those countries and each one of those states. And I was blown away when I found out the state that had the second largest number of volunteers that died at the Alamo was Pennsylvania. I was assuming that the second one would have been Kentucky or someplace else in the South, but the second greatest number were from Pennsylvania.
That's amazing.
Well, Charlie, I really appreciate you mentioning that, because I think, especially if you grew up in another state, people don't understand. I think they only picture Anglos at the Alamo fighting Mexicans. And I think if what you've already touched on, it was really an international group that had come there to fight for the freedom. But also, could you point out that there was a strong presence of people whose native country was Mexico, but were standing for this new land that was being formed? There was quite a few people there at the Alamo of that descent, were there not?
I'm an honorary member of the organization called the Sons of the Republic of Texas. To be a regular member, you have to prove you are descended from people who lived in Texas when it was a republic. And several of the groups of those descendants have some Hispanic descendants in those groups. We have some fellows, a father and a son, in the Lone Star chapter of the Sons, who are descendants of Juan Jimenez and the Jimenez family. But they had relatives who died at the Alamo fighting on this side. The original first temporary vice president of the Republic of Texas was Lorenzo de Zavala. And in fact, he made apparently the first flag that was ever used for the Republic of Texas. And he was the first vice president of the Republic. And he lived very close to where the battleground was. But there were Mexicans fighting on this side. There were Mexicans who were citizens of Texas who were fighting for Texas independence. And Juan Seguin had a group of about 20-some-odd cavalrymen who fought at San Jacinto against the Mexican army. And in order to make sure you didn't shoot the wrong Mexican-looking person, Seguin's men had to put somebody had some decks of cards, and they put some playing cards up in their hat bands. So if you saw a soldier with a hat band that had a playing card in it, don't shoot him. He's one of us. He's one of the good guys.
That's amazing.
They were Mexicans on our side fighting for independence. That just knew that what first of all, a lot of them knew what kind of guy Santa Anna was. Santa Anna was he was a vicious human being and ruthless. And he had learned how to be ruthless when he was a young Spanish soldier fighting under a ruthless Spanish general by the name of Joaquin Arredondo. And ironically, even though we haven't touched on it, we're going to run out of time one of these days. It was 203 years ago today that the bloodiest battle ever fought over Texas independence was fought about 20 miles south of San Antonio and known as the Battle of Medina. Hmm. And it was at that battle that a young lieutenant by the name of Antonio López de Santana was sent with about 200 soldiers to go near an ambush that the Texians had set up along the road coming in from Laredo. They had an ambush set up in the hills, and Arredondo's army had left Mexico and was coming to squash this rebellion of people who in 2012 declared independence from Mexico, independence from Spain. They were about a third of them were Mexican citizens, from this area. About a third of them were Indians who were civilized, and about a third of them were Anglos from the U.S. and other places that had declared independence from Spain. And the battle was known as the Battle of Medina, and it happened 203 years ago today, about 20 miles or so south of San Antonio. On a real hot August day, and the folks from San Antonio heard this big army was coming to squash the rebellion. And they set up the ambush, but Arredondo was a trained military man from Barcelona, and he never took his army where his scouts had not been. And his scouts had come back and said, hey, there's an ambush up about, so many miles, further up the road. And that's when Arredondo set up his own ambush, sent the young lieutenant by the name of Antonio López de Santana and about 200 men to get to the outside edge of that ambush and then play like they saw some folks and come run back. And, of course, the Texans thought they were doing something big, and they started chasing this group of Mexican soldiers, and they chased them right into Arredondo's ambush. And of the approximately 1,350 volunteers they had, they figured at least 1,300 of them were killed that day. And there were supposedly about 55 that died from the Spanish army, but that was the bloodiest battle ever fought over independence for Texas, whether it was against Spain or Mexico. And it was 23 years later that Antonio López went back as the Emperor of Mexico, And he had learned from Arundhato that the more ruthless you were as a general or as a person, the more people were afraid of you, and you could get more things done that way. And probably Santa Anna learned how to be ruthless under Arundhato, even though he may have not had to have too many lessons.
That's amazing. Charlie, we have about another 5 minutes for you to focus in on this. I think people would be a little surprised, too, to find out how Santa Anna came to be captured and, in fact, to be recognized as the general.
When the battle was over with, the biggest disappointment everyone had was that was when Sam, of course, had his ankle shattered. But there was no Santa Anna. He had disappeared. And a lot of the fellows on horseback, their assignment was to travel around through the tall grass and see if you could find some of the soldiers that were still scattered around that may have escaped. And the day after the battle, they found one of the Mexican soldiers in a private uniform down on close to the banks of Buffalo Bayou. And the poor fellow couldn't swim, so they'd captured him because he was afraid to try to swim Buffalo Bayou. And he was one of probably 4 or 5 or 10 or 15 scattered soldiers brought into the encampment where they were holding about 600 or 700 Mexican soldiers as prisoners. And they had no idea who he was. They just thought he was a private. And as they brought him into that area, the Mexican soldiers who were being held prisoner, probably most of them sitting on the ground just relaxing, when they saw who it was, they feared that man so greatly that if you did not give him the proper salute and recognition, they could be killed. He'd have somebody shoot you.
Uh-oh.
And these Mexican soldiers started standing up, saluting, and saying, El Presidente.
Oh, no.
And Earl Santa Anna was hoping they'd also, he was trying to get them to shut your mouth. So his ruthlessness made him to the point where they gave him this wonderful salute, but it also told him, that's our man right there.
Wow.
And Sam Houston got him to write letters to the two Mexican armies, a total of about 7,500 soldiers, who one group camped on the Colorado and one group camped on the Brazos. And he got Santa Anna to write letters to Urrea and to General Filosola, who were in charge of those two armies, to take those men back to Mexico across the Rio Grande. If they would have killed him right away, and that word would have gotten back to the two armies, they would have probably come down and chased after, and Sam and his little army wouldn't have had a shot after 7,500 men coming after him. So it was a brilliant tactic to get rid of those two armies and use Santa Anna to do it.
It's pretty amazing, to say the least. People, here, especially here in the Houston area, but people who might be coming up on vacations, may want to benefit from something you've made available. You have a wonderful restaurant that's very close by, known as the Steamboat House. And there you have basically a working museum where people can learn a great deal. We've placed a link on it if you're enjoying this program by Blog Talk Radio on the website. You can just go below and click on it and go straight out to their website and get more information. But I wonder, Charlie, if you take a few moments and tell some folks about the restaurant, not only how it came into being, if we have time, but also what they can experience when they go there.
The name Steamboat House is named after Sam and Margaret's last home. What really got me to do this was 50-some-odd years, I think it was about 52 years ago, I was given two fabulous paintings. They are 6 foot wide and 8 foot tall each, and one is a portrait of Sam Houston and the other is a portrait of George Washington. And these two paintings were used in the 1936 centennial celebration, celebrating the centennial of the Battle of San Jacinto and Texas independence from Mexico. And I've always said the portrait of Sam is the greatest one ever painted of him. And I was in the picture frame business when I acquired it, and I ended up eventually framing those. and originally put them out on display on the 4th of July in 1976, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the bicentennial of U.S. independence.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten out of the picture frame business and gotten in the restaurant business with my son with another restaurant. And I eventually sold my son my half of Goodson's Cafe in Tomball and decided I needed to build a home for Sam and George. And Washington is right as you come in the entry. Most people never see him. They're looking to the left and the right and don't see this 6 foot by 8 foot portrait of Washington. It looks like a giant dollar bill. And then Sam is in the main dining room. And also what I did was accumulated over a period of about 4 years, accumulated all sorts of things about Texas history. And I have school kids that come in with school children come in early in the morning sometimes before we open up from about 9 until 10:15, 10:20 and teach them Texas history. And then we feed them a nice little meal of chicken tenders and fries and then send them on their way and then clean up the area to be ready for our regular customers that come in at 11. But I also have, as you well know, because you were part of one of those groups, I had a group from Second Baptist Church that came in, and I have lots of church groups of senior citizens come in. Some of them are native to Texas and want to, you know, hear it again, and some of them are for folks that have been transferred to Houston and don't know anything about Texas history and just want to learn some. And I do about 60 to 80 talks a year about Texas history, and I guess I just can't. You got a big mouth and got to keep using it. And I love studying Texas history. And I glanced a little in the second book that was given to me a couple of weeks ago, and it was a book written by the then president of Baylor University. And it's about Sam and Margaret, but it's also, I haven't read it yet, but there's a chapter in there about Sam's relationship to the Lord and what all this president of Baylor University. This is an 1884 publication. But there's a whole chapter in there about Sam, and Sam was a brilliant Bible scholar. When Sam was a U.S. senator, Margaret had a rule that Sam had to follow by, and that was, you write me a letter every Sunday afternoon and tell me all about the sermon you heard on Sunday morning. And Sam wrote a letter to Margaret almost every day. But the interesting ones also were about the sermon that he heard on Sunday morning. He would always write Margaret a letter every Sunday afternoon to tell her what he had heard about the Lord that day.
So, well, Charlie, I can't begin to thank you enough for being with us this evening. The time has flown by, I'm sure, for those who have been listening. And, again, I hope you'll join us again sometime in the future. And
I
hope you've enjoyed our time with us.
I have. I hope the people have.
Most definitely.
Yes.
Jim, thank you for being here. I don't think either of us got a word in because we wanted to save it for Charlie. You had so much to share, and it was worth listening to. So, again, I hope
you'll
join us again. And for our listeners, I want to remind them to join us again next week as we'll continue back in our series. In fact, we'll be dealing with the topic of what to do when you feel confused. So thank you all, and a very special good night.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on Ask the Pastor. If you have a question or a comment for the program, just email us at question@askthepastornow.com. We will try to respond to you either by email or answer your question on air during a future broadcast. Again, that email address is question@askthepastornow.com. Now, on behalf of Jim Simmons, Charles Lyons, and the whole Ask the Pastor team, we invite you to explore our website for great resources. You can also hear previous broadcasts as archives at askthepastornow.com. So, until next time, read, study, pray, and prepare for your life of faith and freedom.